America.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Wiggins America.
The only thing I'm going to need from you guys right now is a cup of coffee.
Wiggins.
Today's global economy waits for no man.
America.
Today's global business climate is like,
whatever, dude.
Hey! Politics is a dirty game. I'm not sure we want to play.
There are forces here at work that you couldn't possibly understand. You have no idea how high up this goes.
Welcome to Wiggins America.
There's a lot of oil that is trapped in the strait right now. It is going to take a couple of months to clear that. In addition to that, we have significant production that has come offline as a consequence of the conflict. For example, you don't see any oil coming out of the country of Iraq right now. They're not producing any oil. So it's going to take a while for us to get more production online that has gone offline as a consequence of the strait being closed.
Seriously, Mike, what you're telling me is that it's going to be a couple of months before we see seriously lower oil and gas prices. Isn't that true?
Unfortunately, we're going to be dealing with elevated prices as long as the strait remains closed.
All right, well, Iran is still the top story of the week, and this is Wiggins America. Thank you for being here. The biggest news out of Iran is that some of the oil tankers have begun going through the Strait of Hormuz, and that's very good news, you'd think. But oddly, the markets, at least initially, reacted negatively to it. I'm not sure why. Maybe there's some other factors there. But I'm excited to see some oil tankers going through the Strait of Hormuz. I don't know about you, because it hurts to fill up the car. And I don't want to keep filling up my car at $5 a gallon in Illinois. Welcome to Wiggins America, if I haven't said that yet. There was a very, very interesting, and by the way, these are Chinese tankers, I think exclusively, maybe one other nation, like Pakistan or something, somebody right there from that region. So these aren't U.S. tankers, and they're not Western tankers. But they're still moving through, so that's good. That's just the beginning. It's the trickle that hopefully happens before the flood. And that flood will hopefully flood the market as well. The reason that I bring this up is not just because that's the news item, but because I saw somebody, I think it was Bill O'Reilly, actually, on conservative talk radio or conservative news radio or whatever you want to call it, news, sharing an idea about how to get prices lower here, at least. Even if it wasn't going to be globally, it would be here. Because our supply is not affected by what's happening in Iran. I think we all have probably known that by now. You hear that and you go, well, then why are the prices being affected if our supply price isn't affected? Well, it's because we are still producing the same amount of oil here. They're just exporting more of it and for higher prices than before. These U.S. oil production companies are not really doing the patriotic thing here. They're not making sure that Americans are taken care of first. They are selling their oil to whoever will buy it worldwide at that high price. They are capitalists. They are making money. And I can't really fault them for that, except that I would just wish that they wouldn't do it. So somebody, I think Bill O'Reilly again, was talking about ways to pressure them into selling to Americans for cheaper, or to American refineries for cheaper, back to maybe pre-Iran prices. And could the government get involved and make them do that? Well, the answer is no. You actually cannot legally, as the government of the United States, tax exports. You cannot do it. I looked it up, and there's a long history as to why. When the Constitution was ratified, it had to do with certain states selling to other states. But now it just means you can't tax exports. And so we can't really do anything about it. But he was suggesting that the president basically strong-arm these oil companies and say, hey, you know that I can't do anything directly, but I can make your life miserable. The problem is, I don't really like that type of government either. I guess when the government is working on behalf of the people doing these kinds of things, then maybe. But quote-unquote working on behalf of the people can mean a lot of things. And it makes me a little uncomfortable talking about it. But I thought it was a creative solution. And it could work. But ultimately, if the oil tankers are moving through the strait, this thing's going to get solved. I keep thinking it's right around the corner. But we'll see. Sounds like it's getting closer. Let's play for you a clip from the other big headline news story this week. And I would say this is not getting any attention, so calling it a headline news story is a little bit deceiving. Let's make it a headline because it's very important.
Wow, Wiggins America.
COVID was proven to be an actual conspiracy, not just a conspiracy theory. That's been the big news of the week, in my opinion, and really not talked about very much. Rand Paul held this intervention, whatever you call it, the government hearing on the COVID whistleblower. The CIA really is on blast right now because the CIA whistleblower came out and confirmed the big news. And I'll read you what Rand Paul had to say, too, because it's more involved than just this. But the big news was that the CIA whistleblower came out and said, and has proof, that the CIA in 2020 knew that this was a lab leak from Wuhan, China, and decided to bury that news basically to benefit Dr. Fauci. And Dr. Fauci doesn't even work for the CIA. So that's a real twisted mess. But here's my ultimate anger about this is not just that the facts are out there and we know what it was now that this was buried, but that the CIA, the current CIA, wouldn't give us that information. It took a CIA whistleblower within the Trump administration CIA. That's how you know the deep state's still alive, because they were trying to still hide it, even now. So I'll read you what Rand Paul said. Today, a CIA whistleblower sat before my committee and confirmed what I've said for years. Government officials, including Dr. Fauci, deliberately misled the American people about the origins of COVID-19. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is sworn testimony. I'll pause there to say, yes, this is all provable now. And the reason that we need to know this is not because it's new information. You already kind of knew this. Now it's proved. And you can say to your friends and family when you're talking about this, if it comes up, whatever, if you're sitting at a bar, you can say, oh, no, no, it's not just me saying this. This is actually proven by the CIA now and by the House Oversight Committee that it's not a conspiracy. They know for sure that it was a lab leak and that they covered it up. All right, back to Rand Paul. It says, let me be clear about what we know. Taxpayer dollars funded risky gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Fauci denied it under oath. The evidence says otherwise. Editorial, Fauci lied under oath. That's going to be a bigger problem. Back to Rand Paul. Today's whistleblower revealed a coordinated effort inside the intelligence community to suppress dissenting views on COVID's origins, including a January 2020 briefing that flagged a possible Wuhan lab origin. That briefing was buried. The American people were kept in the dark. Federal records were deleted. You hearing that? Federal records were deleted regarding this. Investigations were obstructed. Emails show a deliberate campaign to silence scientists who questioned the narrative. This is not incompetence. This is a cover-up. And it cost lives. I've subpoenaed 14 federal agencies for records on COVID origins and risky research. I've referred Fauci for criminal prosecution multiple times for allegedly lying to Congress. I've uncovered evidence that he deleted official records. The stonewalling has been relentless. I'm going to pause here again and say, the stonewalling has been relentless from agencies that are now run by Trump. The deep state is alive, my friends. The deep state is alive. I'll continue here and finish this up. Rand Paul says USAID funneled $54 million to EcoHealth Alliance to collect bat coronaviruses and transport them to Wuhan for gain-of-function research. I demanded answers from the Biden administration. I was stonewalled. USAID kept sending money for years after the connection was exposed. Now, about that pardon, Biden's AutoPen pardon of Fauci may not be valid. If Biden did not personally sign it, it is legally suspect. The only way to test it is for the DOJ to charge someone covered by one of these pardons. I have a suggestion for the test case, Dr. Anthony Fauci. 6 years later, millions of people are dead. Trillions of dollars were spent. Our civil liberties were shredded by mandates and lockdowns. And the man at the center of it all has never faced a single consequence. That ends now. Very well said. Very well done. Needs to be put on blast. That's why we're talking about it at the top of the show. We have a lot more to discuss in this show. Stick around. This is Wiggins America. The new season of From is out. This is a series on MGM Plus, and it is so, it's so mid. It has so much potential, but they waste it on terrible character decisions. You know how you watch a horror movie, and the girl's like, you know what I need to do is go back into the house to get my purse. And you're like, don't go back into the stupid house to get your purse. And she does, and she's like, I'll be right back. It's like the characters are constantly doing that in this series, and it drives you nuts. But it's all based on a really good, mysterious premise of people who drive into a small town, and everybody, and there's not a lot of people in it, but there's people in this small town, and they're of completely various backgrounds, and they've all done the same thing. They all drove into this town. And then they've tried to drive out, and it drives right back into the town. You can't get out. Like, once you get in, you're stuck. Physically stuck. You cannot get out of the town. And so there's this big mystery as to, what is this town? Are we dead? No? Okay. I'm giving a little bit of a spoiler here. One person actually does escape, but then finds that they are just pulled back into it. So you're like, well, did they really escape? Like, what is the world, and what is this town? So it's a great mystery. But they're now, this is the fourth season that they're in, and it just hasn't really gone anywhere. They've added layers, but they've not answered a lot of questions. And usually with a good mystery, it has to build and build and build. It's where you're answering things while you're asking new questions. You know, it's getting bigger, it's getting bigger. And they just aren't really doing that. But it is still kind of worth a watch, just because the premise is so darn interesting. And there are a lot of good scenes, but there's a lot of manufactured drama and not enough forward movement. But it's called From, if you want to check it out and see if you like it yourself. A lot of language, and I'm normally not somebody to really harp on that, but it's weak dialogue, and so they write the language because they're not good writers. I can't imagine seeing a script for a small town, rural America that's just got the F word every other sentence for certain characters. Anytime there's emotion, they're like, throw in an F word, throw in GD, because it's just, they're just not great dialogue writers, and it sucks. But anyway, I say that because I've stumbled upon this really good mechanism to find good stuff to watch, and I wanted to share it with you. It is, have you ever heard of Tubi? T-U-B-I? That is a streaming platform that's free, so you don't have to pay for it. It's got ads. But in 2020, I believe Fox News bought it. So a lot of people don't even know that. And I'm not promoting it because it's Fox News owned. It just happens to be. And so you'll see a lot of Tubi originals. They're making a lot of new movies now. They're really low budget movies. And there are a lot of horror stuff. But they have such a wide variety of things on there. I think they may have more titles on Tubi than any other platform in the world. They just have so many things. But you got to sift through, because there's so much junk that it's not good enough to just read the title and go, yeah, that sounds kind of interesting, or read the description. Because you start watching and you go, man, this movie sucks. You know, there's so many sucky movies that, because they have so much, they didn't really like vet a lot of it. So they have this thing, the tomato meter on there, and IMDb too, where you can flip through these things, and if it has the red tomato on it, that means that there's enough people that have reviewed it on Rotten Tomatoes and said, hey, this is a really good movie. And it kind of sifts through the junk for you. And I'll just click on a random movie and start watching it, just because the people who've seen it said it's good, and they're right. I'd say 9 out of 10 times, if I click on a red tomato movie, they're good. And they might not even be my type of movie, but they're still good. So that's a way to kind of sift through the garbage and not waste your time clicking, and find some good stuff really quick if you're interested to do it. But this is a movie segment, and we're going to do Last Person on Earth.
The last?
Where is everybody?
The last.
It's not the end of the world.
With all the time.
time I need and all the time I want.
The last person on Earth.
I miss the noise, you know?
I thought I was going to be alone again.
There's time now.
If you're not familiar with my Last Person on Earth movie reviews, they go like this. It has to hit a movie or a TV show has to have at least one scene or the plot of the entire thing that hits one of three criteria. A, it has to be the last person on Earth or an Earth-like place, or the character has to at least believe that they are. B, they have to be the last member of the human race, or the group of people has to be the last members of the human race, even if it's not on Earth, like they're in space or something. C is a little bit different than A and B. It is a character or group of characters who are interacting with, encountering, a place where there should be people, but there aren't. And it has to be a pretty big place, like a city or a town, where they come up on a town and there's just no people there. Or they go into a large metropolitan area and there aren't any people. And it's very mysterious. So those are the three criteria. And the more of those criteria my movie hits, the higher it gets ranked. That doesn't mean it's always a good movie. So I rank it also based on just watchability. But the one I'm bringing to you today is a pretty weird one. It's called The Earth Dies Screaming. This was in 1964, and it's the exact type of movie you're picturing in your head. A very over-the-top, apocalyptic type of 1960s movie where it hits all three of the criteria in the first 5 minutes. There's sudden mass deaths that affect the whole world, but we don't know exactly if we can't see the whole world. We're seeing it through the context of these characters, but there's sufficient reason to believe that they are the last people on Earth, even as that belief fades as the movie progresses, as they often do. It's such a weird film to rate highly. I would say general entertainment value is just kind of a middle, like a 3 out of 5. But as far as Last Person on Earth goes, it gets a 5. All right, to short break now, and that's a couple of suggestions for it. That's a weird one to dig up. Go with the Tubi thing, you know? Like, enjoy the little review, but the Tubi thing is really more practical for everyday life in viewing. We'll be right back.
Like the flower.
Wiggins America.
There's a shadow across the
sea. All right, where does the redistricting war stand right now? And are you interested in this topic? I think this is one of the most intriguing political battles that has happened in many years in the United States. And so I am here for it, and especially because it benefits Republicans. I mean, in this sense, we're sort of playing catch up to something the Democrats have been doing for a long, long time. And they have wielded the power of the law against Republicans and Republican states for a long, long time. And recently, as you probably already know, the Supreme Court overturned racial gerrymandering, as in you can't draw the lines of House districts based on people's race. It seems pretty basic. But Democrats are against that because they've been using it for themselves for a very long time. And you know that they have because they're against it. And they somehow claim that it's racist to not have racist gerrymandering. I kid you not. They say that if you had more racist gerrymandering, then you could benefit more minorities. The trouble is they have never used that law to benefit any minority other than ones that benefit them politically. And just in basically red states, they will sue. They can't do that anymore. Now, the news on this that I heard this week, I was on the Mark Cox Morning Show. I'm going to give you an update on the Virginia Supreme Court stuff in just a second based on what we talked about there. But right before I was on with Mark Cox on Tuesday, Senator Eric Schmidt was on. And he, of course, used to be the attorney general for Missouri and was a fantastic attorney general. And some have even speculated that, gosh, that guy would be a fantastic attorney general for the United States. And I have no argument with that. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that, in fact. Then we'd have to have a new senator, and that would stink because he's really good at that, too. But regardless, I think his talents could be used in that way, in a terrific way. And he said this, that he referred to the DOJ or wrote a letter to the DOJ after the Supreme Court put that law out or that ruling out and said that the DOJ should start to go after and prosecute people who do racially gerrymander. Well, guess who is openly doing that? California, among other states, I think Illinois, and then New York. I mean, it's the typical offenders. It's the blue states. And here's the thing. They have openly said that they racially gerrymander in their own states. So if, and it's only to benefit themselves, and it's only to benefit politically, and they've never done it for other races, and they've never done it when it doesn't politically affect them. So obviously, it's all politics, and everybody knows that, and I'll make that case again here later. But the fact that Eric Schmidt has said that he has encouraged the DOJ to go on offense on this was news. And he broke that on the Mark Cox Morning Show. I think that was a big deal. And I don't know whether the DOJ is going to actually do that, start suing California because they are now racially gerrymandering and that is unacceptable and illegal, or whether they will not. We're getting short on time is the problem. But if you would like to know where the redistricting battle stands at the moment, here are your numbers. Republicans right now have about, assuming that South Carolina and Tennessee and Alabama all go through, making those assumptions, they have about 212 seats locked up, according to most experts. How many seats do you need for the majority? 218. So they're about 6 seats short from having a majority outright, which means they need to win 6 toss-up seats in the coming election to have the majority. That's not a lot. The trouble is Democrats have locked up a lot too. They have about 208, and there aren't many toss-up seats. So how do you handicap that right now? I actually would still handicap it toward the Democrats because of the roughly, and I'm just using rough numbers here, 15, 16 toss-up seats. That's less than there's ever been, by the way. And in the future, there will be even less than that. Can Republicans win 6 of 15? It'll be really tight. Their numbers look a little bit better this time than they did last time Trump was in office in 2018. So I'll give them credit for that, but not good enough that I think they could win enough of those toss-ups in what would be a wave election normally. The Democrats could take all 16 or 15 of those and still walk away with the majority. So it's a huge battle. It may not affect this midterm, but it's much more important for the long term. Now, I sat down with Mark Cox, as I mentioned before in this here segment, and talked about the crazy, crazy adventures of Virginia and their legislature and what they're thinking about doing to their own Supreme Court.
American media export. Wiggins America.
And that is that the Democrats in Virginia, after they lost that redistricting battle because of their own Supreme Court, just as you said, are trying to lower the retirement age for any justice in their state to 54 years old. Now, that's not very old.
No, it's not very old.
And the reason they chose 54 years old is because that's the age of the youngest sitting Supreme Court justice in Virginia, which means that all of their Supreme Court justices would be immediately snap retired, and they could replace them with people that they wanted who would, I guess, this would all be just to grab seats in the House. That's the whole point of removing your entire state Supreme Court.
So then the vetting of the new justices would be, do you agree that redistricting was constitutional or not?
And that's
the answer
it.
Is no, you're out. And
yeah.
If it's yes, you're in.
That's it. And
that's it.
There would be, and then they would have to, I guess they'd have to first get people who are all under 54 years old and then maybe change the law afterwards to
keep them in there.
To move the retirement age back up.
A lot of Supreme Court justices don't achieve that until they're late 40s, probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
50.
Well, you know, during biblical times, they had kings who were, 7 years old. And of course, they had other people advising them. But seriously, that's something that the Democrats would do, is they would find some 7-year-old Democrat who they'd try to appoint as the Supreme Court justice. And just because they would be lifetime, right? Lifetime appointment there, even on the state level.
Doogie Howser with a law degree.
You can do it, little Timmy.
Come on.
You've got this.
Well, let me adjust that. It would be lifetime if they made it lifetime.
Okay, so they would be for them if they could appoint someone really young.
If they changed the law.
Yeah.
then they would have to start appointing people, and they might just change the law again to be either lifetime appointments or whatever.
A newborn would be a Supreme Court justice.
Don't you think? Now, the hardcore lefties are going to applaud it, but I think the majority of common sense Americans would look at that and say, come on, that's ridiculous. Like I said with Schmidt, if you were listening to the interview,
yeah.
I don't remember the last time conservatives upset over a Supreme Court decision, took to the streets, burned things, tried to reconfigure the court. I mean, FDR is the last one that did that, tried to stack the Supreme Court. It was a horrible idea, and they changed it back to 9 justices after that. And he only did it because he couldn't get what he wanted, so he put extra justices on the court that would agree with him.
Yeah, and Schmidt said this too. He said, and it was a really good point, this is from the people who claim they're trying to defend democracy.
Yeah.
They're uprooting the whole system just in favor of their party. It's really, really amazing to watch. And just the projection of they're doing this, not us. Mm-hmm. But you can see it happening in real time with suggestions like this.
Well, I was going to say Sunny Hostin, when she was on The View the other day, she made some point about how we need to redistrict all these essentially blue states that have already been redistricted to death. And you look at Illinois, that was one of the states that she mentioned they should redistrict. How can you possibly change that to make it more beneficial to the Democrats when you look at the way that they already drew the lines however many years ago, and it like snakes up from the tip top northern part of the state down all the way? And it's ridiculous.
And you already have that happening in a lot of blue states, but the way they've proposed making Illinois entirely blue with districts and things, if you see those maps, they are contiguous in that they don't split themselves up, but they're not compact. And that's part of the Supreme Court, that's part of the law of the land, is that the districts have to be compact. The problem is there's no definition as to what that mm-hmm. means. So my hope is that if states, blue states, all their population centers are in one spot. So they have to make these long, snaking districts that aren't compact, that I think you'd see that become a court case.
It looks like what my 3-year-old would draw. Show me a space that isn't corrupted, a
peace interrupted. Wiggins, America. Well, I just realized yesterday that it was the 10-year anniversary of my TV show, Songstage, airing for the first time. And I don't expect you to know anything about my history. If you've listened to the show a lot, you may have heard us mention it. We don't talk about it a whole lot. But when Old Roy was on the show quite a bit, he was my business partner when we were doing these TV shows, and we would talk about it sometimes. But Songstage was a show on PBS that aired from 2016, so 10 years ago right about now is when it first started, through 2018. We ended up doing 2 seasons of it, which I realized in doing that show how much of a miracle it is to get a movie made or a TV show made, let alone 2 seasons of a show, let alone that it actually aired somewhere. Because, man, people are in the grind in the industry, as they say, trying to get stuff made. That's why you hear a lot of Hollywood actors and stuff just say, oh, yeah, are you working? Especially with podcasts now. You can listen to their behind-the-scenes stuff, and they just want to be working. They just want to have jobs. And it's the way the industry works, because it's just so hard to get stuff made. So anyway, 10 years ago, Songstage aired, and it was a show about taking a songwriter who had something, just like a basic version of a song, and then watching as we, as our Songstage team, kind of developed it. I was the host of the show and creator, and I would walk them through these different phases where they'd have musicians that would kind of beef the song up, suggest things about it. And these musicians we had were unbelievable, because they could do any genre of music. We picked people from all over the place to do different genres, and then we'd throw them against each other at the end of every episode and have a live auditorium audience vote right there on the spot on who goes on and who goes home. So we didn't have any control over. It was actually a pretty fun show. Not super high production value, but for what it was a pretty good accomplishment. And we got it into most of America from 2016 through 2018 on PBS. But if you don't know how PBS works, I will enlighten you. Not that TV matters anymore, right? I mean, does TV really matter? But this was still 10 years ago, where it was still a pretty big deal. And So to get a network show on a major network, NBC or CBS or whatever, Fox, you have to have the network pretty much doing the show. You can't make something and then just sell it to them. It just doesn't work that way. They have to be involved pretty much from the get-go. And then once they like the show, they push it out nationally to all their affiliates. And all their affiliates pretty much have to run it. I've realized more recently that the bigger you are as an affiliate, like Sinclair has a lot of affiliates, a lot of markets, and they said no to Jimmy Kimmel. They just said, no, we're not going to run it. So they actually have more power than I thought they did at the time. But for the most part, the network's going to say, here's your main programming, and the affiliates are going to run it. And they run it pretty much at the exact same time across the country, you know, different time zones, but same time across each time zone. Well, PBS is the opposite, and it's by design. They do have national programming. They'll have their national, like Downton Abbey was huge at the time. I'm sure Antiques Roadshow is still going now. But these are the big shows that were on PBS. But the problem is each affiliate in each market, they didn't have to run it. They did. They always run the big shows, but they could run them whenever they wanted. So there was no real uniformity to anything. You know, one station might run it at 7 o'clock on Sunday. Another station might run it at 9 o'clock on Sunday. Another station might run it on Wednesday or Monday, you know, whatever their big shows are. So there was no uniformity to their programming. In fact, most of their quote-unquote prime time programming was their children's stuff. This would have been in the days of still probably Sesame Street at that time, Daniel Tiger, and some other stuff that they've pivoted to since they don't have Sesame Street anymore. So PBS was weird, and so you couldn't just sell it to PBS National, our show. You had to go market by market and talk to each market manager, and they were all busy, and they didn't necessarily want to talk to you that bad because they had a glut of people trying to sell them programming, but ours was very unique. There wasn't a lot like that on PBS. What we ran into, which we didn't expect, was that we had 8 episodes of each season. So 4 hours of programming for season 1, 4 hours for season 2. We didn't have them ready back to back, but we did have them eventually. And finding the slot to air it, even if the programmer liked it, it was tough because they'd say, well, I got this cooking show over here that has 100 episodes. What am I going to preempt that to run you guys for 8 weeks for a half an hour? And we were like, yes. And sometimes they did because they liked the show enough. But it was just hard to find programmers willing to do that. Ultimately, we were persistent enough that we did get it into, I think, the way that we always talked about it was that we got it in front of about 40 million people. That doesn't mean that's how many people watched it, but that's how many people could potentially watch it based on the markets that we were in, which is pretty dang good overall after 2 seasons. But ultimately, the reason I'm telling you this story is not to tell you the history of Songstage. I told you a little bit about how the show works, but I realized yesterday as I was thinking about this that I never told this story before about the show because it involves litigation. And I wasn't even, you know, within the last few years, I was like, I don't think I should tell that. But I think we're far enough past it now that it doesn't really matter anymore. So in 2016, our show started airing at about this time, I think. And right afterwards, we learned of a new show coming to, I think, Fox, might have been NBC, that was almost the same premise as our show. It was from Adam Levine of Maroon 5 and The Voice fame. He was the creator of the show. I think he was on it, and it was about songwriters, and they kind of did the same thing where they would take somebody who had a little bit of a song and they'd put them in front of somebody and they'd work with them. It was kind of boring, though. Ours was kind of fast-paced, and I did a lot of joking, obviously, because that's what I do, and I'd do these interviews with them that made no sense. You know, we talk about their song, but then I'd do this ridiculous sort of just skits and stuff like it was Conan O'Brien, and just made the show kind of crazy and fast, and you know, people enjoyed it. We weren't high budget, but we did what we could. And then he comes out with this show that I watched, and I think it was later in the year that it started airing, maybe even the next year. And we were like, oh man, this is either really good for us or really bad for us. I don't really know which way. Oh, Songland. I just looked it up on NBC. And it ran, let's see if I can find it real quick, 21 episodes, so not a whole lot more than we did, from 2019 through 2020. So they definitely were after us. So here's the story and the reason I'm telling this. At the time, my business partner, who had invested a lot of money in Songstage, was like, well, the hell with this. Songland isn't going to come along and steal the premise of Songstage. We've been out longer than he has, which we had. So he contacted a lawyer and said, hey, do we have a case here? And we found an entertainment lawyer that said, slam dunk case. You guys are going to be freaking rich. And I was like, whoa, that's kind of exciting. Except I felt uneasy about it. And I don't know why. Maybe it was just because I don't like lawsuits. I don't like the whole world of lawsuits. I think they are vastly abused. And in this case, I didn't really think Adam Levine had stolen our idea. He just had a similar idea and a similar name to a show. But legally, we had staked the ground first, so I knew we had a case. And so I said to my business partner, I said, you know, we can do this, but I just feel weird about it. I don't think that he stole it from us. I think we just beat him to the same idea. And he said, yeah, that's true, but we have a legal case, and don't you want to make the money back that we've invested in the show? I couldn't tell him no. He had put too much money into the show for me to come along and go, oh, I just have a weird feeling in my gut about it. I said, you do what you need to do. I will be a party to it, but I just feel weird about it. But, you know, you got to make your money back, and if this is the way you have to make it back, then okay. And the lawyer, I remember a phrase this guy said. It was something, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't in the room when this happened, but he told me secondhand. He said, the lawyer went, here we go. We're going to sue Adam Levine. And I was like, okay, that's a little bit too enthusiastic. But he was going to get his name on the map. And I'm like, and maybe this is why I feel so weird about it. Ultimately, what happened with that case was, and I think this is a God thing, because I couldn't tell him no. I couldn't say, no, don't get the money back that you spent on the show. It just wasn't my place to do it. But ultimately, when they went to file the lawsuit, they found one key thing that was going to kill us. And we ended up not filing it at all. They had registered the copyright for Songland 1 week before our first episode aired. Now, we still had a case in that we had the show before they had that copyright. And I think we had copyrighted our name before they had copyrighted theirs. But the case got super weak because we couldn't prove that they had seen our show before registering their copyright for their show. And the whole thing fell apart. And I was always sad about that for my friend who had sunk a lot of money into Songstage. And, you know, I guess there was a part of me that was like, I wouldn't mind being rich. But I just didn't like the way that it was happening. And I always viewed that as like God's, you know, we could have started that show running on a certain PBS station that was the sponsor station in Central Illinois, really at any time. And so we happened to start at that date, which was 1 week too late for that lawsuit to work. And I said, okay, I'm fine with that. The whole thing fell apart. We never sued Adam Levine. Just thought that was an interesting story. And it's 10 years ago, pretty much this week, that happened, that first episode aired on PBS stations here locally. Thanks for listening. This is Wiggins America. See you next time.